Joining us for this edition of Track Record on Share Radio is diversity specialist Stephen Frost. He runs his own consultancy these days, but one of the highlights of his career was being in charge of diversity and inclusivity at London 2012. A warm welcome to Share Radio. It's very good to meet you.
Likewise.
So, Stephen, give us a hint about where you've come from. Your current business is still quite new, so what lies in your background?
My background's very commercial. It was in advertising, it was in management consultancy, quite classic in a way. But I fell into diversity and inclusion, really, because of the elephant in the room. I felt that, you know, I was passionate about gender equality or gay rights or disability inclusion. But I also felt it was the elephant in the room in the sense that, you know, people would often get promoted who weren't necessarily the best. We often would exclude people from decision making. Environments or cultures weren't necessarily inclusive. And that led me on to work for Stonewall and then the Olympics and KPMG, really focusing on this cultural work. There's two things really, Sue. I mean, one is definitely personal. I'm a gay man. My sister's got a disability. I come from a working class background. All those kinds of things that I think, you know, kind of sharpen your senses as you grow up. But I think in terms of the professional business piece, because I've been in a very commercial environment and run big P&Ls and been in advertising and consultancy, I think what really got me into it was the sense of fairness, really, that if we wanted a meritocratic workplace, that was synonymous with a fair workplace. It wasn't mutually exclusive. It wasn't either or, that you had to achieve fairness at the expense of meritocracy. It was actually the same thing. And that led me to this idea that, crikey, we could tackle some of these things, which would be a win-win. It would make fair workplaces and more efficient businesses.
Can we rewind the clock back even further? Now, the boy Frost, what were your early ambitions?
Oh, crikey. I think when I was very young, it was probably to be a zookeeper or a national park ranger. I loved the outdoors and really didn't have much of a clue otherwise. But I loved my geography. That was one of my passions at school. So I think the travel and the outdoors and the sense of adventure was high on the list. But certainly not wearing a suit and being in a commercial environment at that age, no. I think the first kind of major job after graduating from university, albeit a little bit delayed, was advertising. And that was quite a sharp introduction to the corporate world, because you've got a lot of responsibility at a very junior level. And I was called MJAM, or Most Junior Account Man. And I'd be the one that had to pay for taxis, pick up dry cleaning and so forth, which was an interesting use of a Oxford degree. But it was very much dealing with the clients and the P&L at the front. And that was a really good baptism of fire, really, into managing a business.
Let's hear your first track record choices. Now, this takes us back to the 1980s. It's A-ha's Take On Me. Stephen Frost, why this?
This is really the first ever cassette I bought. I went to an A-ha concert with my dad and then girlfriend, Lizzie Merriweather, at the Harrogate Conference Centre back in the mid-80s. It was a wild night, I can assure you. And then 25 years later, when A-ha were doing their final farewell tour, I went to see them again, this time in London, but with my boyfriend, and Lizzie came along as a friend as well. So it's quite an iconic first purchase for me, A-ha, and this song is definitely historic for me.
Away.
Joining us for this edition of Track Record on Share Radio is Stephen Frost, the man who founded Frost Included. That's an organisation which is all about diversity and inclusivity in the workplace. Now, this conversation is going to be a lot about diversity in business. Now, your highest profile engagement so far was with the organisational committee at London 2012. And I'm wondering, how did you become involved and how far out did you get involved in the project?
It's been a childhood dream to work on the Olympics and Paralympics. And I remember as a kid, you know, watching Blue Peter and getting involved and sending in ideas for various bids from Manchester or Birmingham or London. But when London won the bid, when it was preparing for the bid, I was in the States. I came back and did an internship, and I was quite keen to get involved with Barbara Cassani and Sebco and just try and get involved in the bid. And then it was only a few years later, when I was finishing Stonewall in 2007, that actually there was an ad on the website. I'd been checking the website fairly often, and there was an ad for an executive assistant to the CEO. And the work I'd done at Stonewall was quite high profile. I wanted to apply for it anyway, and the headhunters called the same day as I was applying. And this kind of childhood dream then, you know, propelled me to go through the series of interviews and so forth. And I ended up at my final interview having a spaghetti bolognese with Paul and Seb, the CEO and the chair, at Paul's house, and took the job. And, you know, I'd never been, you know, a massive professional sportsman, but I'd always had a passion for the Olympics. And I think that passion combined with just diligently checking the website, the work I'd done previously, set me up. And credit goes to Paul Dighton, who I think, you know, didn't choose a conventional candidate for this role, but obviously chose a wonderful candidate for this role. And I worked my socks off for him for 5.5 years. I was employee 57, so in really when it was a startup, and then we grew to 200,000 people. So it went through that startup phase, corporate phase, almost army phase, and that was from 2007 to 2012.
And looking back now with the benefit of hindsight, did you hit all the goals that you'd set for 2012?
I mean, it was wonderful. And I think, you know, people have been very kind in their praise for it. And I think it definitely went better than we could have dared hope at the beginning. But you never achieve everything you want to do because there's always room for improvement. I mean, I think in terms of the big diversity goals we had for the Games, yes, we hit those big goals. We had a phenomenally diverse workforce. We, I think, created a real culture of inclusion, both on the park and in all the messaging and the culture we wanted to create around the Games. We had some legacy projects, particularly around disability hiring, accessible venues, dealing with homophobia and transphobia in sport, gender equality and so forth. But, I mean, there's plenty of things we didn't get right. And some of those things will forever remain secrets, but some of them are, you know, public record, whether it's a clock stopping and life imitating art, as it did in 2012, or whether it's, you know, the furore around ticketing, or whether it's, you know, the Chinese torch relay that we hosted 4 years prior, which was quite touch and go. So many things.
Have you ever worked with an organisation quite like it? I mean, I can't imagine that there was any similar model to work towards.
It's interesting. Because I think yes and no, really, Sue. I mean, on the one hand, it was unique because going from this startup to a major corporation to an army with a defined deadline, the mother of all deadlines, on a project of such international significance was unique. And I think the sheer level of complexity and so forth involved was quite unique. But some of the lessons and the parallels, I think, are very transferable to other organisations. And indeed, because I think that deadline, those things that appear at first unique, actually help other organisations, you want them to be transferable. So if I look at lots of organisations I work with now, whether it's the military or banks or government departments, a sense of urgency, a sense of transparency, a sense of accountability are all good things to help get good work done. And I think that those lessons are really helpful.
Let's hear your next track record choice, Stephen. On the list is Dee Reams' Things Can Only Get Better, which might be best remembered as a rousing Labour anthem. Is that how you remember it?
Well, yeah. I mean, for me, it's one of those songs that we love to hate, But then actually, after the elation, cards on the table, of the 1997 election victory, the landslide, Blair's landslide, we all rushed out to buy it at the shop on the high street. And all of us who'd said we'd never buy it actually met, you know, I think in the music shop at some ungodly hour in May 1997 and laughed as we were all buying it and it was flying off the shelves. And I think, you know, I choose it because it was a moment in time. I think lots of people can remember it. But I think it's also got current relevance too. So I hope you enjoy it.
Stephen Frost from Frost Included is alongside. Stephen, right on the front page of your website is the motto, "We help people understand diversity and inclusion and provide solutions to organisations to do this." Now, even in this, as I like to think of it, very open business world that we inhabit, do you still encounter organisations who just don't see the need for what you do, who see diversity as a simple case of counting the colour of faces or something?
Yes, unfortunately, Sue, that's still very much the case. I think because, you know, all of us in business have multiple pressures. We often think about this as an afterthought, if we do at all. And then often then it can become an annoyance because it can be perceived as an opportunity cost on doing other things which are more relevant to the business. But actually, I think that whole approach is a misnomer. And so we try and go about it in a very different way, which is to say, we're not trying to sell diversity to you. You know, look out the window. Diversity is a reality, right? Whether it's skin colour or thinking style or political persuasion or, you know, diversity is very much a reality in our world today. The choice is around inclusion. The choice is, what do you want to do about it? And in all those things on your to-do list, you know, are you thinking more effectively about it from an inclusive perspective? So it's not about thinking of it as another thing to do or an opportunity cost, but rather how you do your day job. And that conversation is one which is quite fresh for a lot of organisations we first work with. And then when they get into that, it's great because it unlocks a whole load of innovation, creativity and new approaches, which people generally find helpful to the business and helpful to the bottom line. You know, be led by the client, be led by the business. And there's, you know, what you don't do is go in finger wagging saying, you know, thou must be more diverse. I think what you do is where are they at the moment and where do they want to be? And how can you help them? So, you know, for some people, it is quite almost token, right? They want more women or they want more people. And fine, if that's their goal, OK, we can help them. But I think for a lot of other companies who are a bit more thoughtful about this, it's actually, you know, we're facing an unprecedented competitive situation, or we are really urgently needing to innovate or increase creativity, or we really need to, you know, think differently about our product range or whatever it might be. And then that goes into cognitive diversity, the idea that actually we want different brains, we want different minds. Anyone that's kind of been in the closet in some shape or form can empathise with other people in a similar situation. And also, when you do that, you have to develop covering tactics and relationship building skills that you don't otherwise have to do. And they stand you in really good stead. You know, we all actually don't fully bring ourselves to work on occasion. And that's a shame. It's a shame from a personal perspective and a happiness perspective, but it's also a shame from a business efficiency perspective. And there's a lot of work that's gone on to talk about this idea of covering. And, you know, everybody does it. And everybody, I think, can benefit from a little bit of uncovering.
Next on Track Record is Procol Harum's Whiter Shade of Pale. Why, Stephen Frost, does this make your list?
So I just love this song, end of. But also it's a moment in time with one of my best friends, Corey Clausen, from Harvard. We were both at graduate school together, both rural lads from the country, who had kind of come to this eminent institution, Harvard. And this was a song we both loved. And a lot of people like it too. And I think it's a beautiful and quite meaningful song. So I hope you enjoy it. We skip the light fandango. Turns cartwheels across the floor. I was feeling kind of seasick. The crowd called out for more. The room was humming harder as the ceiling.
Purple Harem and A Whiter Shade of Pale. This is Track Record on Share Radio with Stephen Frost, who's our diversity and inclusivity expert. You write, you speak in the course of your career, as well as running Frost Included. That's very different from your earlier career in advertising. What was that world like and why did you leave it?
I think advertising can change the world. It can be an amazing business, and it's very, raw and meritocratic and client-centered and commercial and creative, and can really make a difference. But I think for me, when I look at what I was working on in advertising, clearly there's some accounts that I felt were more meaningful to me. So working on, for example, the disability campaign to change people's awareness of what disabled people can do as opposed to what they can't do, was a meaningful campaign. I just wanted to do that full time, and I wanted to do that in its entirety, which is what led me into diversity, really. I had some quite hilarious fails there. I mean, if you wanted me to talk about those...
Go on, then. You might as well tell us an anecdote.
I can, obviously, within the boundaries of respectability. One was, I was working on a campaign for toilet paper for a very well-known toilet paper manufacturer. Which was not the one with the puppy. And, the client was focused on science and technology and conveying this to the audience. But actually, that was boring. I mean, it's toilet paper. So we came with this idea of scrunching or folding, where we commissioned a lot of focus groups in the United States, Germany and Britain, and found out that in the United States, when people visit the throne, they're liable to scrunch. They take lots of paper and scrunch. Whereas in Germany, they're very disciplined and they fold. And of course, this client wanted us to do more scrunching than folding because it sold more toilet paper. And we just took this example and kind of ran with it. But when we presented it back to the client, they weren't overly impressed with the... Despite the amazing insights that we had about, you know, how people wipe their bottoms. But unfortunately, I think the client wanted more science. And so I was removed from that account, yes. But that was one of my main little fails in advertising. I think, isn't the mantra fail fast, fail early, fail often? Isn't that what we do?
Yes.
Because I think again, if you think what I do, which is try and make companies more diverse and inclusive, one of the reasons that they fail to do that is because they're afraid of failing. Mm. So they don't even try. You know, they don't they're reluctant to hire people who are different from them because they think it's not going to work, and so they don't do it. They stick to their own kind. But I think a little bit of willingness to fail a little bit will help you actually overcome that and take some risks, which will be definitely in your own interest.
So there's something that didn't quite go so well, but you do say that one of your proudest moments was the opening ceremony at London 2012. You also cite your work with Stonewall and your work with the armed forces too.
Stonewall, I guess, came before, so maybe I'll chat about that. But, back in 2004... gay rights, as it were, was still quite controversial for many businesses. It was still seen as very much a lobbying issue and so forth, and people knew of lobbyists and what have you. But for the military, it was even more so, because it was only 4 years prior, in 2000, that the government had changed the law to allow lesbian and gay people to serve in the military. Before that, you couldn't. So, you know, when I was at university, I couldn't be in the officer training corps, for example, because I was gay. So... this was quite raw. And even though the law had changed, the culture hadn't. And so I started working with the military in 2004 and had an inordinate amount of meetings with them to gain trust and to build relationships that I was a good lad and, you know, had their interests at heart and so forth. And then we reached something of a watershed, because one of the wonderful things about the military is that they have a very clear mission. And at the end of the day, a lot of enlightened officers in the military will be open to any idea that will enhance the mission. And if you take the Royal Navy, for example, you go to sea in a ship or submarine for 6 months. You're a family. And so you need to work as a family. And does gay people being out help that or hinder that? And does it help the mission or hinder the mission? And so in 2005, there was a moment when I was airlifted into the mess room of Ark Royal, which was the then flagship in the UK fleet. And all 50 captains of the 50 ships in the British fleet were in the mess room for a training session. And I had 20 minutes to talk to them about gay rights. And I was terrified. It was 50 big burly blokes with huge watches and folded arms, you know, listening to me for 20 minutes. But it went on for over 3 hours. And the questions just flowed, and then we'd had the discussion. And it was a genuine watershed moment, because I think the majority of these captains had this almost weight lifted from their shoulders. They could talk about this, that actually we were interested in their operational effectiveness. We did understand their business, and we did want to help. I think what supermarkets today are doing in terms of accessibility for their customers and making an inclusive shopping experience, from even, for example, turning off the music for half a day for folks who might be autistic to shop in peace, these again are things which weren't happening 10 or 20 years ago, and they deserve credit for that. So I think we should hold up those companies as beacons that are doing great work, and I'm very happy to do so.
Stephen Frost from Frost Included, it's been an absolute privilege and a pleasure to have had you join us for this edition of Track Record. Thank you for coming on and being so full of anecdote. Your last pick is Heather Small and Proud. Why this?
I look back with a lot of fond memories. It was a wonderful 5.5 years, quite a roller coaster. And at the lowest moments, in the hardest times, I remember this song, which was our bid song. And I think it's still true today as it was back then.
I look into the window of my mind. Reflections of the fears I know I've left behind. I step out of the ordinary. I can feel my soul ascending. I'm on my can't stop me now, and you can do the same, yeah. What have you done today to make you feel proud? It's never too late to try. What have you done today to make you feel proud? Mm-hmm. You could be so many. Still so many answers I don't know.
Track Record with Sue Dugan.